seeing you up here. There we go. Okay, I'll just listen then. Good afternoon, and welcome to the RIPE 58 Anti-Abuse Working Group session. I do hope you all enjoyed your lunch, and you're all now awake and not suffering from any kind of afternoon slump. excuse me. So, we have a few things on the agenda today and hopefully some very interesting discussion. Update on a few different things that are ongoing and a cry for help somewhere in there as well. The two chairs, just to let you know, myself, Brian Nisbet, and the co-chair, Richard Cox. We have wonderful people from the NCC who will be doing our scribing and jabbering and our technical support, and also our wonderful stenographer. I do not actually have any idea how we used to live without them. Just a quick note on microphone etiquette. If you do have something to say, then please say who you are and where you're from before asking your question or making your point on anything this afternoon. So I slightly tardily and with a slight mistake in the middle, sent out the minutes for RIPE 57 during the week, which there was a couple of questions about. So unless there are any points that anyone wants to raise now about those minutes, then I will consider them moving from draft to approved in one glorious magical moment. There haven't been any sudden additions to the agenda. What we are going to do is flip it slightly, and we're going to have Bob Bruin's presentation before we go into the botnets and bad guys community response section, and indeed everything else. The kind of everything else in the agenda is going to be mixed together in a selection of kind of updates and comments after we have the opening presentation. So I'm going to stand down from here and invite Bob to come up, and we shall have that presentation.
Can you hear me okay?
Great.
Ah, thank you very much. Okay, I'm Bob Bruin, and again, a disclaimer, if I talk too quickly or I say insane things, please wave your hands and make me repeat it or explain it differently. This is a continuation of the talk I gave earlier in the week, but we're trying to show how we use policy enforcement to do it. I will repeat a few slides because I think they're important. One of them is the fact that, again, you must keep in mind it's all about the money. If you don't put the money in there, nobody cares. And that includes all the honest, regular people like the registrars, the resellers, but the criminals, if you take away their sources of money, they will probably go away. Well, it's probably. And we'll repeat the policy. I've discovered that RIPE has a lot of policy people here, so I expect you will understand how important good policy is, because it does make a difference. What we have done is we have looked at the policies, which is the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, and this is U.S.-centric because we have more registrars as opposed to CCTLDs as Europe seems to have, and most of the world has, actually. And what we did, we looked through the RAA and looking for loopholes. And some of the loopholes we found were interesting. The most important one was the who is data accuracy. If you complain to a registrar in the U.S. and .com, .net, .edu, and you say, this is inaccurate, they have to look at it and verify that you're correct. That's ICANN. Then they send it off to the registrar, who verifies it as well. And then they send a note off to the owner of that domain and say, please fix it. You have 15 days to fix it. If you don't fix it, your domain name is suspended. And we've used that as a loophole in the sense that I don't know any criminal that tells the truth when they register. So it's going to be inaccurate no matter how you look at it. We send mail to them first, it bounces, we know it's inaccurate. And that we start the process then to take away the domain name. And this has worked very well over the years. In the beginning, when my son started doing this by himself, he had 10 people where he worked who were getting a lot of spam, and we shut down all the registrars. They got no more spam at all. Now, it's not true anymore because they've now bought and parked millions of domain names. So if you take one down, you'll just use the next one. So we need to make sure that we have enough people doing this and the complaint systems balance out with the 50,000 complaints we used to be able to put in and get, you know, crashed your system, and the 50 million new domains you can register in 1 year. They should be sort of in sync. And now they are with ICANN's new complaint system. And again, I'll point out, we have focus, because there are just two of us, on the RAA up there that goes from ICANN to registrars. But we have pushed ICANN a lot to make modifications in the registrar accreditation agreement. We're pushing them for a few more. Right now, the one that I want to get changed, which is meeting with resistance, is that a registrar has a choice. When you register for a domain name, they can verify who you are and your address and all the other stuff that goes on. Or once a year or so, periodically is what it says, they can send mail to you and say, check your registration. If it's inaccurate, please fix it. And all the criminals go, oh yeah, it's fine. And they don't fix it. So if we had enough resources, we would go after everything. Part of the problem we have with criminals is they are infecting the resellers, the registrars. Every one of these places has got criminals working inside to take advantage of how the rules work. So the world looks the same to us as it does to them, except they're not good guys. And the example I've used for 15 years or more is that you have a surgeon and a scalpel, or you've got a murderer and a knife. It's the same. It depends on how they use it. And they will sneak in as resellers. They will use privacy protection, not because they're afraid of some fascist, you know, domineering government, but just because they don't want you to find out who they are. And some of these privacy protect services, they cycle through the mail generating, you know, hundreds of digits of name, you know, random digit names of email. So if you try to use it, you know, 10 minutes later, it's something else. And you can't ever send them email and complain. We find that wholly inaccurate and not going along with the registrar accreditation agreement, but we're still fighting that battle. Now, as I mentioned before, I'll talk a little more about it. The who is data accuracy problem has been going on forever. It was a problem in 1982. It's still a problem today. There are a couple of different kinds of problems. One is that many people, especially in the EU, I suppose, don't want anybody's name available because they want it kept private. And the original thought about this was you don't want spammers, you know, scraping off all the names and sending spam out just because you own the domain. But we don't care about individuals. You can have all the privacy you want. We care about people who make money. If you are a criminal and you send spam and take money to do it, you're a business, you know, it's a transaction, it's a contract, it's services for money. So we do want to know who you are. And in the real world, businesses are public. They don't hide behind secrecy things most of the time. Occasionally they do, but generally speaking, they don't. If you sell stock, you're a public company, you file reports to the SEC in the United States. Big 10K reports, all kinds of information. You have to put up salaries and all kinds of stuff. You have to file with the IRS. You're not secret. On the internet, on the other hand, they try to be secret and think it's okay. And we don't think that's okay. He said they're required to correct this. The controversy still goes on. There are plenty of people who want to sabotage any kinds of correction to this in ICANN and in some of the committees. You know, it's a constant battle. We've had hearings. The General Services Administration issued a report in 2005 saying, we're going to fix this, and you should do this, you should do that. And, of course, nothing's been changed. And so we said, hey, this is a great loophole. We can make them take down the domain names, and we have. And we've closed down about half a million sites were breaking the law in many ways, but mostly the problem was is they had inaccurate information. And it can be automated, and we've done that. You send a mail, the mail bounces, the WHOA's record's inaccurate, we file a complaint, again automated, to the tune of 3,000 to 10,000 a day, and then it goes through the same process, and it's a standard process, and they will take down the domain names, which is why the spammers, and when I say spammers, I'm talking about the any malware guys, the phishing guys, anyone who's trying to steal money, you know, the fake mortgage companies, all the criminal activity, they will have a parked name and reuse it. You can't do that very often without the registrar helping out. That's where we published our top 10 list. There we go. To point out who the worst ones are. So this is our standard procedure. It works pretty well. We will be expanding it this year. I think you'll see a lot of ICANN changes this year. They made a lot last year. There'll be more coming, and there'll be more activity. I can't tell exactly what it is, but I'm guessing there'll be lots of it. But the one thing we've found that's the most important is no matter how much we do of this stuff, putting it in the public eye makes a difference. We've been accused of the name and shame game because we will tell you who the bad guys are. And what that means is if you're a business and you have your domain name or hosting service or whatever with one of those bad guys, you run the risk of losing it because they will be shut down. So you might want to make a business decision to move it to somewhere to a better registrar. And this is the top 10 from last year. Shinnet's still the top one for this year. All the other ones under Beijing Networks have all had breach notices from ICANN, and they have either been shut down or have begun to behave themselves, except for DirectAI, which is it's in Mumbai, India. They have cooperated significantly. When S Domains was shut down, they got S Domain stuff transferred over because the escrow system was already set up, and that was very nice. But we and other places vetted the names going over. And if we knew they were bad guys, said, hey, don't let them do it. So that worked pretty well. This is this year's list. Again, the first time a Russian registrar has made it up to here. These guys are now mad at us because they don't want to be associated with the really bad guys at the top. Enom we find to be a very bad registrar. They're an American registrar. Shinnet's in China. Network Solutions is cooperating with us significantly. They'll go off our list next year for sure, unless we do one quicker. Planet Online is really not a good place, and I'll show you why in a minute. Wild West Domain is actually owned by GoDaddy. They're not happy about this either. Oh, come on. There we go. Now, to be fair, we have criteria. We just didn't decide that you're a bad guy and we don't like you. We thought about things like, how big are you? It's not fair in our mind to say that GoDaddy has an absolute number of bad domain names that send out spam compared to another smaller registrar whose absolute numbers are small. I mean, GoDaddy's got 35 million or so domain names, and they're bound to get more problems, but they're actively trying to do something about it. We know registrars that have got 90% of their domain name holders are bad guys. You know, there's no question about it. So we tried to balance that out. We also tried to say, well, you've got some spammers, but you're not spamming a lot. You know, maybe there's like spamming, you know, 20 people, and they're just an annoyance. Or others are sending out billions a day, and they make a difference. So that's another criteria. So we try to look at the whole rate of things they're doing, including the subjective one. Are they cooperating with us and trying to help? Oh, this isn't fun. There we go. Now, I do have charts on these. I assume these will all be available to people. But you can see here, Enom has more spam names than anybody, and Planet Online is second. And the rest aren't so much. And one of the problems you have is, like any good criminal, they will fit into a crowd to keep from being noticed. A few don't care and they get caught more easily. But by and large, if you've got, you know, 10 million domains that are paid for, and you got, you know, a couple hundred thousand criminals, you're making good money off of it, and you kind of keep them under the radar. But they don't always do that. Oh. There we go. Now this one shows up a little bit better, where one sort of stands out that's planted online. Okay, they are really bad by spam messages by the registrar itself, because we can add up the numbers by the individual domains or by the registrar. And percent of domains spammed. This one here, again, Planet Online shows up way worse than the rest. There is a site called Domain Name Wire, which claims to be the most read by registrar's website. And they decided to redo our categorization of the bad registrars. And they picked this as the only criteria that mattered. And we don't care. You want to change how we do it? Fine. We gave them the numbers. They published an article about it. And they said, this is the worst registrar. It's Planet Online, not Shinnet. Okay, that was the way they want to look at it. That's fine. Oh, it's almost worked. Okay, let's try that. There we go. And again, this is another one. Just shows up the same thing per domain. So per registrar, per domain, you can tell by the most messages. And again, what we've done, all we've done here is we've collected email from all over the world. We have 37 countries represented, and just added them up. Yeah, we didn't do any magical numbers on, didn't manipulate them at all, just added them up so at the end of the year we could say, hey, this is how many came, this is what the numbers look like. So there's no real, you know, subjective part to that except for the criterion. Now I do have to respond to being criticized, being a jingoist the other day. In the Whois record, I am all for local languages, and I think there's a big difference between a common language that everybody uses so you can communicate. You use English here, it's all mostly just a second language, just so you can talk to each other. It's not the same as me forcing to use English just because I'm in charge, because I'm not. It's been true. Latin once was, French was, English, and maybe one day it'll be Chinese. They got 1.5 billion people there. Yeah, who knows? But that's really all that is. When I talked about the Whois record, that has been in English since the beginning, because the internet was pretty much started in the U.S., and as it spread, it kept the same kind of language. And I don't care that a person's name is spelled differently in their cultural language because there are different characters in other languages or addresses or something. But I do care that the name of the registrar should be something I can find in a common language that everybody can find and know who they are. And what I complained about was that the Chinese, the bad registrars, not all of them, are starting to use Chinese characters in there because they know that no one can read them. I can still match the characters, they don't even have to know who they are, but I can figure out who they are as well. But they're doing it to hide, and that's not the same thing as trying to push their culture, because the rest of the record is still in English. And you can look up any of this stuff yourself with the Whois record. It's the same. So what I'm trying to point out here is that replacing the name of the registrar is kind of a problem. The addition of a Chinese character register name with the English name is perfectly fine. You know, I'm not trying to push English, I just happen to have been born in a country that speaks English first, and I'm sort of lucky in that way and unlucky in other ways. But it's not about making it be English, it's about having something that's common that we can all use to talk about. Okay, I just couldn't let Randy's comment go. And this is what I talked about, is that the Chinese characters, the registrar name and the registrant, but not the addresses. You know, the rest of the Whois record looks the same as everything else. And I know they're doing this just to make it more difficult for us. We get new little things every day by the spammers to make things difficult for us. You know, they hide, they know we're going after transaction sites, they put a whole bunch of extra websites in there starting with underscores and all kinds of characters they got to strip out just to make it more difficult because they're trying to slow us down. But what I'm worried about is that other places like the Russians, for example, will start using Russian characters for the domain, for the registrar name, and other carriers will do it, like the Middle East, and that will make it harder to find out who the bad registrars are. It won't be impossible, it's just another slowdown point. If they want to have the English and their own, that'll work fine. What's that? Who, me? Sure.
This is Richard Barnes. I'm wondering why language is really such an issue here. It seems like actually what you're...
Oh, because Randy Bush called me a jingoist on the other day.
Well, but for your application, it seems like really what you need is a unique identifier for the registry, which could be a stream of bytes for all you care.
Oh, absolutely. What I'm looking at is the way the WHOIS record is set up now, and I'm nowhere near against trying to change that, so that could be done better. I thank you.
Please do remember there will be plenty of time for questions and discussions after the talk. Cool.
Okay. Now, the other thing we've been looking at, too, is that the policies exist, but we find them broken. And we want policy reform. And we've done a lot of that the last round of ICANN. You'll see a lot of changes coming up in the next ICANN meeting, which is in Sydney in June, I think it is, and one in Korea in October. The RAA has had a dozen changes added to it, and a lot of people are interested. Some of the policy reforms that we want is transparency. One of the things my son found is that, and we got this fixed last year, is that of all the registrars listed at ICANN's list of registrars, a huge number of them did not have their honest address. And I don't care if you live in Mumbai, but I don't want you to tell me you live in Beaverton, Oregon, New York, and that's where your business is housed, because it's not. I mean, that was actually Direct Eye. They had a mail drop box in Beaverton, Oregon, but didn't know the difference between, you know, the different states. And it just looks silly, because in the background, all the registrars know where everybody lives. You know, and they exchange that amongst themselves in case there's some reason they got to talk to each other. All right, so we just wanted the same thing, and we had a fight with them for months just to have that transparency. Okay, and that's what we're looking for in all of this stuff, is more and more transparency. And the more we get, the more stable things become. Now, I'd like to see policies that do that. You don't have to, no problem, do anything special. Just don't hide, because for the most part, it's perfectly fine. It's a worldwide operation, lots of different parties working on it, it's great. We do want to have the WHOIS data verified at registration. And this is really hard, because they really don't want to do it. They will check the credit card you've got in there to make sure you pay them, but they won't check to see if the WHOIS data you stick in there is a known bad set of data. I mean, we have 60 of them we know about where they've mixed certain things, like a phone number in Holland and an address in Brazil, but the state doesn't exist. You know, it's all very set because they automated it. So they've just kept repeating the same mistakes over and over again, and we'd like to see that stopped. And we're trying to put together a database so they can look it up more quickly, because we'd like to help them, because by and large, they don't know what to do. The email thing is easy because you can send email, it bounces, you know it's broken. But if you want to start looking at other things, it involves a human being, which takes time, and they have to investigate, and it stretches things out. And by that time, you know, the bad guys have disappeared. I worry about the resellers, because they've been pushed out of this country, and some have gone back to Eastern Europe, but they're sneaking in. But resellers range from someone like the size of Yahoo to some guy who lives in the Ukraine. And they're slipping things into the channel, and there's no way for the registrar to tell that that reseller is a bad guy until something bad happens. And there are those email guys who will promise that the email they send is not spam. And the spammers are attacking them as well and sneaking into their systems, so that'll ruin their reputation and ruin their business, because it's hard for them to know. So if anyone's got some free time in their hands, there's a serious problem trying to figure out quickly that a reseller is a bad guy before the damage is done. And it'd be nice if you have that. So some ideas, but nothing. There we go. What we're pushing on here, again, I mentioned this, is the fake online pharmacies. We've worked with LegitScript. Again, we think this is obvious. Pharmacies around the world have to have a license from their government, state governments, federal government, you know, whatever it is, they have to be licensed to sell drugs that are controlled. It's over-the-counter stuff, nobody cares. But in the United States, it doesn't matter. If you have a server in the U.S. and it's selling some controlled substance, you don't have a license, you don't have a prescription, it's against the law. I don't need to be a cop or a lawyer to figure that out. And that's something to be done automatically, because these numbers are all available publicly. And we have been talking with pharmaceutical industry representatives, you know, the national pharmacy boards in Europe and the equivalent in the United States. And you will see over the next year a lot of work done in this area. I point out again, this pumped up on the internet was a report. It was just on steroids. And we picked that because it was easy. In the U.S., you cannot sell steroids without a license. Okay, and it's also caused all kinds of problems because a lot of professional sports guys have done it and gotten caught. Now, in India, I understand that you're allowed to sell it over the counter without a prescription, but not on U.S. soil. So different countries have different rules about this. If the server's there, they're going to be in trouble. For the first time, about a month or so ago, the FBI and some others actually arrested people because they're trying to take advantage of the financial crisis and sell fake mortgages to people and shut down websites, and they arrested about 50 people. And that's the first of many to come of that nature, because it's slowly catching up to what it means to be on a website somewhere and a server in the U.S. And even though spam generally has the majority coming from the U.S., it's not all U.S. Individuals doing it, it's other countries having servers on U.S. soil using the great networks we have and the better service and the cheap cost to send their stuff out. And that's going to change during next year. And we'll look into anything that's an illicit pharmacy site. The steroids report was pretty good. Like I said, we shut down hundreds of thousands of sites using the data, and you'll see more of that. And I didn't go over this closely enough, but I do want to mention that mostly for law enforcement, they worry about bureaucracy. There was a nice presentation the other day by the COIT people on what they have to go through to get information. And from my perspective, it's all like, who is data? It's pretty safe. Everyone's worried about their own privacy. You don't really have to get into the privacy aspect of this. But they want to look at details. They need warrants. They need evidence. You know, they need to take a long time to do things. And they want to put people in handcuffs. I don't really care, because I look at this and I see, look, you know, you've got a problem with you. Who is data? We're going to shut you down, because I know you're probably a liar. If you make a mistake, fix it. Straightforward. Not a big deal. I don't have to take much time to do that. And the difference in time is also a difference in cost. And if you look at the number of arrests that have happened because of some malware site or phishing site versus how many we've taken down by using WHOIS data, it's a, you know, one of these versus one of these. This will be it, actually. And part of the problem we have is that, you know, there are so many things here. These are the guys stealing credit cards, stealing identities, setting malware, doing botnets. It's just an infinite amount of stuff in the ecosystem to keep it going. I look at it and say, well, there's nothing wrong with FastFlux. Companies like Akamai use it to keep their web servers going. A botnet itself is just controlling other computers. I got a bunch in my house. I use a botnet to control them and be perfectly fine. It's the difference between what people do with what they have. And it's much harder to find them if they look like they're okay, and they're really not until they've done something wrong. So all you really want to see happen is people should obey the laws wherever they are. You know, you shouldn't run the red lights, and you shouldn't run over people in the streets. You know, there's no reason to disrupt privacy, because we're not talking about individuals. You know, and one thing I think is happening is that, especially with the registrars, there's a change from the entrepreneurial spirit into an institutionalization of something. Now, every country has done this, where they've had all kinds of battles and struggles, become a country where they institutionalize the parts that keep the country together. You know, legislatures and bureaucracies and things, to make it work. And they're in that transition period, and they're going to fight it tooth and nail. And they're going to lose in the end. It will be one way or the other. There will be certain kinds of rules. Last story here. I'm not a smoker. I never was. And I always didn't like it when people smoked in elevators and cars. And it was a long time ago. My kid was like 5 years old. And eventually the U.S. government decided smoking is bad too. We did studies on it. And what's happened is that because of the resistance, it's gone so far past, though I think it's wrong. There are people going to get arrested for smoking in a car with a child under 12. There are places in California you can't smoke in your own apartment. You know, there are certain parks out in the air you can't smoke. You know, it's a big swing. I think the harder they resist, the worse the regulations are going to be. Instead of cooperating where they could control how the regulations come about and make it easier for themselves, they're not going to do it. No one ever does. They put their feet in the ground and say, this is it. And I'm here. Okay. And you want to hold questions now or later?
Now.
Okay. So,
all right. Right. Well, listen, thank you very much, Bob, for that. Are there any questions?
Hi, I got lots, but
okay.
That's a list.
I'm going to keep it down to four because
I can't remember more than one at a time.
Can you say who you are and where you're from?
My name's Malcolm Hutty, and I'm going to keep this down to four because we really can't do a complete fisking of that presentation. But I really want to make, I think we kind of need to make 4 points, the last one of which really is going to be a question.
Okay.
Firstly, you said that earlier on in your presentation that on privacy, you didn't really care about the privacy of individual registrants, these companies. Forget about the privacy of the individuals. You don't care about that. You're not looking into that. It's not an issue for you. Well, under European law, at least, it is an issue, and you're going to have to deal with that.
Well, what I meant was is that I'm not looking to get into the privacy, and I actually think Europe's done it better than the U.S.
On the Chinese characters issue, 1 billion Chinese people don't write their name in Mandarin just to piss you off. Yeah, if you want to read their addresses, you better learn their script.
No, I disagree with you because what I'm saying, if they want to add a line that says registrar in Mandarin, go ahead.
But you're still saying that they have to use a Latin script as well.
Yes.
So they have to learn the Latin script so as to have access.
No.
Access to the ability to be able to register a domain name and enter them.
No, they already have been using the Latin script.
A normative rule in the registration system should be that they must be able to provide their address in a Latin script in an ASCII style script.
Yeah, but they already do.
Sorry, but tough. Yeah?
It's already true.
There's no reason why they should agree with you that is an acceptable norm.
Well, they don't. But the thing is, the rules say they have to. If they want to change the rules, they've got to change it a different way. They can't just arbitrarily do it.
I spend a lot of my time in the regulatory space trying to deal with this whole, a lot of the intergovernance issues, and I very rarely am on the same side of it as the government of the PRC. However, on this one, I'm sorry, you just have to deal with it. You've got to see where they're coming from.
I do. They're hiding who they are.
No, and only the spammers are, but this comes on to the next point.
No, it's also shinnet.
Okay, this is point three, so I am making progress. Okay. You're assuming that anything that's inconvenient to you or that gets in your way or that is unexpected is evidence of evil doing. Yeah, that's not true. The spammers might be doing that, although to be honest, I'm not even sure that the spammers are putting it in Chinese just to hide from you, because I'm not sure you necessarily
no,
sure you're making
not
that much
doing
impact.
It. No, spammers are not doing it. The registrars are doing it.
But the ordinary Chinese people that wish to have their addresses represented in their own script that they are capable of reading
it's
themselves.
It's not their addresses. You're not paying
it.
Attention.
Oh,
it's not their addresses. It's only the registrar name, not the name of the person. Okay. All the rest of it's still in Latin characters.
Okay, well, I'm going to move past this one to a question so that I can kind of wrap up on this, which is on the pharmacies issue. This was put to you in the plenary before. Yeah, but I think you didn't quite understand what the question meant, so I'm going to try and put it to you again. Tylenol is prohibited in Dubai. You can buy it over the counter in the United States. The last right meeting was in Dubai. If you'd bought Tylenol into the country in Dubai, you would have it confiscated and maybe bad things happen to you at customs if you got caught. Yeah. So what are you saying? Are you saying that a American online business that is selling Tylenol without a prescription, as it doesn't require in America, should have its domain name removed as a way of shutting down that business if they post that Tylenol to Dubai? Is that what you're saying?
No, what I said was, and it made this clear, didn't get across apparently, this is U.S.-centric. On U.S. soil, these are the rules. The other countries, I can't do anything about that. That's why we're talking to the National Board of Pharmacy in Europe to see how they would approach that and we'd make those changes. Now, I use these steroids in India as an example because you can get those over the counter, as far as I know. But the thing is, you can't sell them to Americans, especially if your server is in America.
Right, but by the same token.
And they're trying to distinguish between the jurisdiction of the United States versus other places.
But doesn't the principle of reciprocity apply? If you're going to ask other countries not to sell drugs to Americans, then should not you not, by the same token, at their request, stop selling drugs to them?
In my opinion, they should do what I am suggesting for the U.S. They should, in their country, say, you can't sell Tylenol to Dubai citizens on the net.
Okay,
yes,
and
I
that also
that.
Includes, if it applies to
I
Tylenol,
can't tell
then
Dubai
why doesn't
what to
it
do?
Also apply to pornography, or for that matter, newspapers? Much of the stuff that's in the New York Times is illegal in many countries. Are you going to have the New York Times' domain name removed at the behest of the Myanmar regime?
If, in fact, they are breaking the law in that country, then they have the right to do that.
Okay. That's my case.
There's a certain amount of censorship involved in this stuff. I prefer no censorship whatsoever for a whole lot of reasons. But at the same time, if I believe that in my country you should follow the rules, that should apply elsewhere.
Okay. Well, you just agreed that the New York Times stands to lose its domain name under your proposals at the request of
well,
the
if they had
regime.
A New York Times
There's a word
dot
for that.
Dubai
it's Duccio ad absurdam.
New York Times dot Dubai, given out by Dubai, they could take it away. But if it's given out in the United States as a .com through a registrar and through VeriSign, then they don't have the right to take it away because it's not in their country. Whoa. Whoops. No.
That's being eager.
I mean, these are not simple questions.
Okay,
that makes me nuts a bit. So, Peter Koch, have you just said that the .com top-level domain is a U.S. national top-level domain?
Say it again.
Say it again is good. Have you just said that the .com top-level domain is a U.S. national top-level domain subject to U.S. legislation only?
What I said was the NewYorkTimes.com is in the U.S. They did get it through a registrar in the U.S. and through VeriSign. What happened in the rest of the world, I don't know.
Well, hang on. VeriSign is a registry for .com, right?
Right.
This is why you say they got it through VeriSign.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is, so that would apply to all .com domains because you can't get past VeriSign for any .com registration in the first place. So what you're saying is that all .com registrations are subject to U.S. local laws only.
If they are selling something in the U.S.
How can a domain sell anything? I mean, a domain is a name I register.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So what rules should apply there? I'm not understanding what you're after here.
Well, the rules.
We're talking about the internet, and the inner is the same prefix that applies to international, right? So you're trying to advocate national boundaries, and I'm not sure I'm in the right movie here.
Well, there are boundaries because of jurisdictions. You know, the U.S. cop that has no rights whatsoever in Europe that I know of, you know, even if he saw a criminal act in there, he can't do anything. There are jurisdictional issues. And I'm saying that if you are selling something in the U.S. that's illegal, especially if it's a server in the U.S., and it is a .com server, then, yes, you are subject to U.S. laws.
Okay, first of all, the web server's location and the domain name and the registries and the registrar's positioning on the planet are completely distinct issues. So what if the web server is actually located in, what do you say, Myanmar?
Mm-hmm.
And the domain name still is a .com domain name?
Mm-hmm. And are they selling something in the United States that's illegal?
Okay. Then they should have.
Is that part of your question?
Then they should have taken their .com domain name away?
If their WHOIS record is wrong and they're selling illegal drugs, yes. They would take it away.
Okay.
Someone make me sit down.
Yeah, I think that's the point. Richard? Yeah.
Right. Why not? Hi, Richard Cox from Spam House. A couple of questions, which I found the presentation quite challenging and interesting.
That's not usually a good start.
Well, I think we all found it quite challenging and interesting, possibly in different ways.
Usually a warning for what's coming next.
Yeah. No, looking more practically, you gave us some very interesting lists of registrars and the ones you thought were good and the ones you thought were bad.
Mm-hmm. Based on spam levels.
I'll tell you now, that list didn't come as any surprise whatever to us. Mm-hmm. But I was interested that you didn't split the difference between domains that are registered for illegal activities and domains that are registered for activities which, while perfectly legal, are antisocial. And I'm talking about the marketing of surveys and free gifts by unsolicited email. That's perfectly legal in, the country you come from, mm-hmm. certainly. Mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, it is in the UK, unfortunately. But yet, that's unacceptable to us as netizens. Have you ever done any analysis on that list of registrars and their spam load based on the split between that type of material and the pharmacy material which is spammed out using botnets, for example, which, I mean, that's illegal whatever jurisdiction you're in pretty well. That's a clear indication of bad intent. And I just wanted to put to you that you might find that...
The answer is no, and basically the problem is just my son and myself, we do this on the side.
Yes.
We don't have the resources to go there. If we had resources, we'd do more in-depth stuff like that.
I'm just
that.
Suggesting it is something you might want to look at.
No, it's perfectly reasonable.
Secondly, you spoke about the Registrar ICANN accreditation agreement, which is good to look at. We found it very practical too. You didn't mention 3772, which... does provide you with the takedown in 14 days for bad whois, but it also...
Once the registrar has been notified by the registrar.
But it does also provide for instant takedown where the bad whois is willful.
There are rules that say, for example, you can't have a felon running it, like Esther Maines was.
Oh, yeah, but no.
And you cannot knowingly engage in illegal behavior or allow the domain... to engage
we're looking
in the
here
behavior.
At whois accuracy issues, well. Specifically whois accuracy. Mm. And you've made the point you can get the domain shut down after 14 days. Most spammers don't expect their domains to last 14 days anyway, and if they do, we're not doing our job.
No, in fact, but they usually last 5 days. There's a paper from the University of California and Steve, they found 5 days, but at the same time, that was a domain tasting period as well.
That's been fixed.
Yeah, just happened
to match. What I'm trying to communicate here is there is another clause that's already in the agreement that's not being enforced. And as you seem to have an ear at ICANN, it might be well worth looking at whether it can be enforced. And that is the requirement for instant takedown where there is obvious intent to put a willful false whois.
Right. We found that more difficult because for some people, this is pornography, but for other people, this is not. And that's why I preface the pharmacy stuff. It's not quite the same as the whois data accuracy. We're stepping out a little bit from what we
But leaving most of the fields in a whois record empty or putting meaningless words in there, mm-hmm. that is willful data inaccuracy as opposed to accidental or possibly intentional.
Yes.
And under those circumstances, you can get an instant shutdown. Another thing that you might want to think about. Under 3773, of course, the registrar is liable for anything done by somebody who's used his privacy service.
Yep.
Which brings me on to the last point I wanted to make to you, and I'll give you some thought about how you do things. If you get into a situation where you can shut a domain down quickly with bad whois, then you can be sure that the whois is going to become very, very credible. Spot on right zip code every time, and usually it'll belong to the exact same guy whose credit card details they stole to buy the domain in the first place. This isn't progress, unfortunately. I wish it was. We're looking for progress. So I would say when pursuing whois data accuracy, be aware there's an own goal sitting out there. For a very good example is this. We chased a spammer the other day for bad whois data on a particular registrar. And his registrar said to him, we've got this complaint about your WHOIS data. You'll need to fix it. Oh, and by the way, if you don't want people to see it, we've got this privacy service as well. Again, progress? I think not.
No, no, they're fighting back. It's a war of escalation. It's a question when you can get to a tipping point.
Are there any more questions? Please.
Hi, my name is Uwe Rasmussen. I work for Microsoft, and I fully support what Richard Cox just said. It's really a very difficult way to fight against spam. Even if you get the domain shut down, they will only use the domain for spam for 24 hours. After that, it has already been triggered by all spam filters and is being blocked by any good spam filter. So what may be a better way, it's just a suggestion, but we've found it's better to try and have the accounts closed down of those spammers, because they may have registered 1,000 domain names, and they're
or
just
a million.
Or millions, yep. And they're using one at a time and exhausting them that way. But if you can shut down his entire account because it has been used not as bad WHOIS, but it has been used against the terms of use of the registrar, then you'll create more damage to him also. And it will be more difficult for him to register one domain per account or 10.
Well, we're trying to escalate as well. And I will say one thing. It was about 4 years ago, Microsoft worked with the Attorney General of Massachusetts, Tom Riley, and spent 9 months gathering evidence for a Russian spam game that was in Springfield. They arrested them, plenty of evidence, and they spent, I don't know how many tens of thousands or million dollars to do this. They were bailed out and went back to Russia the next day. You know, and it was just all that time and energy wasted. What we did by shutting the domain names down was faster. They just found better ways to do it. In 2007, there were 50 million domain names registered. 30 million came from three registrars, and that's an ICANN report, not ours. So, you know, I understand the problem. We're looking for ways to get better at it. And we'll take any help we can get, spare change.
And the WHOIS information, I mean, it is very sensitive. As you could see from the gentleman back there, it is a very sensitive topic. Mm-hmm. People that register a domain, it's not that they want to be known publicly, like somebody that registers a trademark. Of course, if you register a trademark for public services, you want it to be known to the world. Whereas for domain names, people sometimes register a domain name, they want to use it with hundreds of their closest friends, but not with the 6 billion people of the world. And another difficulty is, although the EU Privacy Directive does not go beyond identifiable persons, many European legislations have also data protection for businesses. So you're not allowed to just publicly divulge any information without consent of those businesses, and they may not want to divulge that publicly. So this makes the WHOIS public information, or accuracy of the WHOIS information, privacy protection services, a very difficult debate still.
I agree with you in general, but you have to understand, we have looked at the privacy protection stuff for a couple of years. I have yet to find a single legitimate use of it. And millions of illegitimate.
It's the privacy protection that people are interested in, not because they don't, you know, they want to be a system critic. It's just because they don't want the information out there. And
we haven't found that. What we have found for real is covering up criminal behavior.
Yeah, I'd
like to looked at this carefully.
I'd like to move on from just last gentleman, and then we'll move on from there.
Okay. Hi, my name is Aaron Kaplan. I work for CERT. And you mentioned that it's an escalation, and you're waiting for that tipping point. I might just add that, as far as I can see, with all the financial the money flow of spam, et cetera, and all, you know, all malware that we're seeing on the internet, I think the tipping point is not in your favor for this particular solution.
Oh, we're very persistent.
Well, no, it's. I think
we were told 5 years ago it wouldn't work.
Different solutions to the problem would actually be more efficient, like following the money stream, for example.
Well, except for one thing, nobody has shut down and stopped spam as much as we have. And we can document that. Nobody. Not a single place.
Still, my spam levels are increasing and increasing.
If the spam filters worked, There'd be less spam today than there was 10 years ago, 5 years ago, or 2 years ago, and all they do is filter it out. They don't stop its production.
And on that note...
I disagree.
But I welcome, you know, any help I can get from anybody.
I think this is a conversation we could continue well through the rest of the session, the coffee break, have it during the 20-year celebration, you know. But seriously, I think we'd like to leave it there. So thanks very much, Bob.
Thank you very much for listening.
Right. The next talk is, excuse me, glass of water is apparently useful. So Richard is now going to give us a talk about some current trends in malware, botnets, and abuse that are ongoing and very prevalent right now. So it's a very much of an up-to-the-moment tour through what's going on.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, this mic up. Yeah, that's okay.
This thing is working.
Oh.
Okay.
Dear.
This is the left side.
Shall I put this over?
Yes.
This is working? Oh. Dear me, technology.
This is the left side.
Oh, right.
You can put this on your
hands. Oh, sorry, don't need that.
No, sorry. You need to put this on your hands.
We should have had a rehearsal. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Before I start on the main talk I want to give you this afternoon, which I shall give, if you like, on behalf of Spam House, I want to separate roles slightly and say something in my role as co-chair. You very kindly elected me to this post a couple of years back, and since then I've been remarkably absent. Some of you might have wondered why. Had I had a row with Brian? Well, I can assure you I haven't. That's almost impossible anyway, but he's actually a good guy to work with. But in fact, I had surgery just over a year ago, and we hoped it would improve a problem. It actually made the problem worse. I've had to take considerable rest over the last year. The meeting immediately after the surgery was out anyway, but Dubai, because of the temperatures, would have been a major problem. So while Brian and I have been in regular contact, I've been very low profile otherwise, and if any of you feel that's let you down, well, I would like to make an apology at this stage, so at least everyone knows what's happened. Right, changing hats, botnets and bad guys. And bad guys to us, of course, are not just the ones we call criminals, but they're also the ones that flood in mail inboxes with junk email, even where it's legal. And of course, the problem is that in the US, where a lot of it is generated, it's legal, as long as you do certain things. I'm not saying they all do those certain things, but the enforcement of that part of the law is somewhat lax. The CAN-SPAM provisions are rarely invoked unless something else has upset somebody. Not an ideal basis for enforcement in any jurisdiction, but that, I think, is where we are today. So whereas we could previously block by filter sources that we knew to be sending spam, and we could block automatically anything sending us a lot of mail unless we knew what it was. This is a technique used by people like AOL, Yahoo, etc. If you were going to send them a lot of mail, you had to get whitelisted, and there's a process for that. Well, the latest technique from these guys is what we call snowshoe. Snowshoe because if you are walking across snow, you don't want to put too much weight on any single part of it, so you spread the weight across a very large flat area. That's exactly what these spammers are doing at the moment. They started by just having blocks of perhaps /23 full of random host names with one domain name or random domain names, things that were totally meaningless. And they would change these from time to time. That worked moderately well, except that the domain names were caught up on. And then once the block had been caught sending a volume of spam, it got blocked. And the block stayed there until the spam stopped for a period of time. Well, they got wise to that. I mean, as I was saying just now, whatever you do to these guys, they'll get wise to it. They'll find a solution to it. You've got to be a step ahead in the dynamic in working out what they're going to do next and try and cover that. So the latest technique is not just to rotate around individual IPs in, say, a slash 23, but to rotate those slash 23s or 24s, whatever, with each other at numerous different hosting providers all over the US and, of more recent date, one or two in Europe. That's relevant to the RIPE community because, of course, those of you who are doing hosting may get one of these on your blocks. And you may see your customer say, oh yes, sorry, we had a bad customer who was spamming from there. We've terminated him. You'll see the block go quiet. Nothing comes from there for a month or two. Well, nothing's actually happened. This is the problem. The guy who terminated their customer, he was the spammer, and all he did was shut that block down until the reputation for that block on the various reputation services like Senderbase has aged off, and then they go back and use it again. One particular guy in the States who's very fond of this technique is Darren Wohl. He's a Florida spammer, tends to have perhaps as little as six IPs on any one particular hosting provider, but he's got about between 10 and 15 hosting providers across the States, and he rotates his domains and IPs between those hosting providers. You can always tell Wohl's traffic. He always uses .org domains because of the limitation in looking up .org domains. Some of the cheaper registrars, of course, don't really care how many domains you do or who is on. .org gets very, very fussy about that. So if you have to look up a few hundred domains, you're going to find it's going to be a very slow process on .org. And he tends to use mail. In almost every case, so mail.garbage1.com.org, mail.garbage2.org, and so on. Very distinctive, these patterns, and you get to recognize them. We are now having to do analysis on these and identify to ISPs that, yes, they've got a spammer, even though the RDNS on the block has currently been wiped, and even though there's no mail from there, you've still got a spammer. Believe me, that is a difficult argument to deliver until such time as the hosting community understands this new threat to their reputation. Because at the end of the day, it's their IPs, the ISP's IPs, not the spammer's IPs. And if you get a permanent black mark against them anywhere, it's the ISP that ultimately suffers. Let's go on to botnets. Quite a few of them around, you may have noticed, and a lot of them are sending spam. A lot of them are doing things a lot worse than spam. That is one of the reasons why it's good that we are now the anti-abuse working group and not the anti-spam working group. So Conficker is a very high-profile botnet at the moment. It's a Trojan, obviously, running on PCs, talking to a command and control. That's quite normal. Multi-layer and encryption to protect the communications. That's also becoming the norm. We were certainly able to intercept communications before, but they found that sending them in the clear wasn't quite such a good idea, so they adapted. Now they're encrypted. Conficker, however, has got a very interesting feature, which I thought it worth sharing with you today. It's been three versions of it so far, and for some mysterious reason, we've called them A, B, and C. Now, up to now, there were a few domains the Conficker used to find its host, find out where to get its command and control if ever it lost contact with its base. Because obviously, once you find out where a botnet is being controlled from, first thing you do is get that server shut down. And as long as it's not in certain jurisdictions, that's actually quite straightforward. So the bot has now got to find where its command and control has gone when it's not where they thought it was. And the original idea was to register a few domains and put those into the actual code, and it would go and look up host names on those domains. Well, that was quite easy. We got them taken down. And then we got an early version of the next one, which had about 500 domains coded in it. That was a little more difficult. It cost some money, but what was actually done, someone went out and registered all the domains that were being used or could be used by that bot. As a result, it couldn't get much command or control. That worked. The latest version now can generate up to 50,000 domains per day. That's a bit different. And needless to say, they aren't going to register 50,000 their domains today, and neither are we. The cost, the administration, etc., somewhat difficult. Configure C has domains in quite a large number of TLDs, certainly in UK, Austria, New Zealand, Australia, and all the top-level domains. All the well-known top-level domains, anyway. And the approach has been taken at the moment is to ask registrars to take down domains that are in use as command and control, and also to not allow the registration of domains that the bot has put into its code. It's an algorithm now, it's not an individual list, and the idea is that the bad guys will go out and register a domain when they want to. They know what pattern of names the bot will try on a particular day, and they go out just before that and register the domain name. Well, obviously, the only solution there is to get the registrar to refuse registration of those domains. Now, in top-level domains, moderately good success. In country code domains, things are different. Country code domains, they tend to be very independent and insistent on their right to do things their way. And in some cases, that means doing things which conflict with the best interests of the internet as a whole. Configure D is the one that's actually going to carry, I think, the main payloads. There's been nothing of any significance seen on Configure C so far. We think Configure C is a proof of concept, and that Configure D will be the one that takes the heavyweight payloads. But if their plan is as we understand it, which is to examine Configure C and see which registrars and which top-level domains will block registration of their chosen codes, and then they're going to stick to all the others. This means that as a community, we've got to share with each other the need to protect ourselves against this type of activity. Configure is a major threat to the usability of the internet. Obviously, it does all the things that a botnet will do that are bad, like putting in a keylogger and stealing all your passwords and credit card details. I mean, you know, there is nothing more chilling than have to go and help somebody, and that's happened to me, whose home computer has flagged up from a firewall that they've got a Trojan on it, and then the next week explain to them why their credit card has just been used the other end of the country to top up an anonymous mobile phone. It wasn't that person's fault. They didn't do anything wrong. They didn't go to any bad websites. I'm assuming that nobody here would say that installing Windows was a bad thing, but that was the only thing they did that had actually allowed that Trojan to get on their machine. So we are dealing with a very high threat. And when you find a command and control center, sometimes it is on what you might call bulletproof hosting. Sometimes this is in China, although there are ways to deal with that. The latest we're finding, particularly in the RIPE region, is the hosting by means of a fake entity setting up an ASN, asking for IP ranges, using completely bogus information. The entity that checks the information is, of course, the LIR. The LIR may well be in the same country as the entity doing the crime, and the LIR, of course, may well be subjected to what we might call local pressures. You know, bribes. This doesn't help us. So it came as no surprise just to find last week one of those entities operating with ostensibly an address in Scotland that looked perfectly like a reasonable company. Yes, there were alarm signals to say this is not a Scottish company, this is Eastern Europe. And when somebody went to check the address, they found that it was empty. The same address that Rhipe had exchanged contracts, under normal circumstances, that's the process, with that entity a few weeks before, because that entity was the LIR. So we've got to sit back and think, and I know Brian wants to talk about policy development, and we need to do some policy development and give some policy advice here. But Rhipe is exposing itself as a friend to the bad guys by not having central validation of the holders of ASNs and IP space. APNIC and ARIN both have central validation. They make sure they know exactly who that space is going to. We don't do that. And obviously, we are seeing the bad guys coming to us fairly consistently, and we are seeing a lot of blocks being registered by entities that almost certainly do not exist in the form that they tell us they are. And some of them will be the Russian Business Network under a new name. A lot of you will remember the Russian Business Network, which set up base in the UK a couple of years back and then mysteriously disappeared one November when it suddenly appeared to go to Taiwan. But what hadn't been spotted first was that the trace route to Taiwan was generated by a trace route simulator and did not match the BGP announcement status. Quite a lot of you, I think, will now recognize the importance of BGP. And if a trace route doesn't match the BGP announcement status, you've got a trace route simulator in there. And if that doesn't tell you you've got a bad guy, nothing will. So there we are. That's a very brief rundown on the situation today. I'm happy to obviously to take any questions.
Are there any questions for Richard? There are a number of questions for Richard.
Hi, I'm Richard Barnes, VBN. So I think that you're on a good track suggesting that, that Rhipe and the other RIRs indeed have contact with these organizations that are doing bad things. But I wonder if you think that there is a scalable approach to doing this sort of verification and validation that you're proposing, or are we going to have to form the investigations unit of Rhipe?
Scalability is always important, and as I said, whatever we do, they will find countermeasures for. Rule one in my book would be to make sure we are alert to the problem and not look the other way and say we're all good guys. We wouldn't do that, would we? Because the bottom line is we're not all good guys, and some of us would, and it only takes one. As far as checking is concerned, it seems to me reasonable that there should be a physical mail flow between Rhipe or an RIR and an entity that uses its services. Limiting yourself to email leaves you wide open to misrepresentation of facts. That's known as fraud in some circles. So I think that doing something is better than doing nothing. If you do something and you've still got a problem, then you've got to go and think about it. But what you don't need to do is ignore it, because it ain't going to go away.
Hi.
Gentleman at the back there.
Yeah, Aaron Kaplan again. I just want to add to something that you said. I just want to say that the blocking or the registering of the domain names for ConfigureC, the big, frenzy and hype that was going on in the registries. As far as I know, and I have been discussing this also on the Configure mailing lists, and basically the result was the updates from B to C happened without the domain names. And I just want to state that one more time. I'm pretty sure about it. My answer, my question was on the mailing list. Does somebody disagree? The answer of Paul Vixie was well, basically, we can still at least monitor the domain names now. That's interesting for sure, but I just want to say that one more time. I think that's a very important point. Because good botnet like Configer, really smart one, used multiple approaches.
That is the key. It's used multiple approaches, which means that the domain route is just one of the ways it can communicate. But trying to shut the others down while the domain route still is there as their backstop is not going to work. So we've got to cover all options.
Bob?
I just wanted to mention power of our networks was deaccredited a couple of weeks ago by ICANN. My son had sent them a letter to Texas last year, and it was returned as no such person at this address. And from there, we built up the reason why they should be deaccredited, and they were. So sending mail through the post actually is helpful.
It's helpful in a country where you can rely on the postal service to return it if it doesn't get there. There are certain countries in which that is not the case. I wouldn't like to apply that test to the Ukraine, for example.
Yeah. The gentleman at the back there, sorry.
Yeah. Dmitry Kochmanyuk, .ukraine, Ukraine domain operations. I would agree that if it has sent mail to Ukraine, you may just not get it back. And remember, fake mail, fake postal mail, is as possible as fake email. On the configure front, I have to add that we have decided to block all the configure generation B domains on the registry level. It was a decision that was hard to make, and unfortunately, the switch to configure C leaves us no way to pre-populate the registry because the names are no longer known in advance. And as far as your comments on the RIPE registering ASS for unknown parties, I think that the only way to approach that is to use a system similar to, say, credit card processing, is when you see a certain LAR to do too many of these bad registration, find them, and if the percentage is, let's say, higher than 2 or 3%, just decredit them. That's the only way you can deal with that problem, unless you want to do all the registrations yourself, and that's probably not what you want to do, otherwise you wouldn't have the LAR system in the first place.
Anyway, well, Aaron and Apple.
Postal mail is a good thing, but it would not save your. You couldn't just rely on that as the only source of verification.
Well, okay, Max.
If somebody can.
Sorry, can you just say who you are?
Yes, Max Tuliev. If somebody can receive the real goods by postal mail paid with fraudulent credit cards, so I think there is no problems to receive the mail and send this mail back to. For example, to the RIPE and CC. So I think if postal mail will be mandatory for registration, it will delay the registration process, but gives no real opportunity to detect spammers or something like that. So it's it will make some difficulties, but not stop spammers.
Yes and no. I'll take the last two points together because I think it's important. If you require a round trip physical mail within a certain number of days, it doesn't delay the registration. If you get too many failures for that, then you can trigger an alert and say you've probably got a bad LIR. As I said in my presentation, APNIC and ARIN do not use LIRs, and I think they know why they don't use LIRs, because they know what the risks are. So if you send a postal mail once a year, and what Nominet do in the UK, they give you, I think it's about 14 days, you get a postal mail, it contains a code in it, a bit like a... cipher, the word's gone right out of my mind. The check code that you put in when you do a whois lookup. Capture, thank you. Oh, by the way, we found that anti-capture domain was on the block I was just talking about, which was registered by this fake LIR. But if you put a code similar to a capture code in the postal mail, which then has to get to the recipient. Now, you might at first sight think to yourself, okay, anybody can open that mail and phone the message through, which is true, and that's not a problem. The point is, if somebody at that address gets the code through to its destination, then if a crime has been committed, and I stress the if, law enforcement can go and ask and find out who received that letter and who phoned the code through or forwarded it, where did it go. There is then an audit trail, which is better than no audit trail.
I said that if law enforcement can't find out where real goods like computers, cars, so on, disappeared after receiving at certain postal mail address, I think same will be with postal mail. So it's it adds some difficulties, but makes no advantages in real life. Maybe it's Ukrainian specific. Maybe in other countries, postal mail work in different ways. And also, I experience about 10% of postal mails sent within Ukraine and Russia are lost.
Yes, but we're not relying on the bounce of the postal mail to flag the problem. We're flagging it on their failure to enter the CAPTCHA-style code that was contained in the postal mail. So in other words, we're checking whether it got to the address given and was opened and actioned at that address, which is, I think, a worthwhile thing to check. The more we force the bad guys to do specific things that are visible and fraudulent, the more chances we have of getting them to leave a trail that law enforcement can follow. At the end of the day, with the really deliberate bad guys, law enforcement are the only people who can deal with them. Our concern needs to be to protect our networks and our reputation.
So you say not about send postal mails to all customers, but only if there is something strange happens.
I'm not sure I understood that one.
I think that the issue of sending postal mail around the RIPE region, it was one that was touched on in the general meeting yesterday evening. I think that it's an acknowledged issue in certain countries and in certain areas around the region. So I think that I'd like, you know, if we could just end that particular part of the discussion there.
Okay.
While that may be something that gets looked at some point, we are aware of the fact that there are issues getting mail to right members, and certainly in a timely fashion. So if we can acknowledge that, and just there's a few other people who...
Oh.
Okay.
Yep. So.
Hi, Uwe Rasmussen. When we discussed the domain names, we also had the discussion, should we try to exercise more control on the people that try to obtain this internet resource, the domain name, or should we find a way to shut them down more efficiently so that we change the game, whereas they now can register a domain name at the click of a button in a second. We need to use at the very least 24 hours, if not more, to shut down the domain name, because we need to have to be able to identify it as being used for spam. We need to find out who's the registry or registrar. So you know, the dynamics are not in our favor. I think this is a little bit the same question here. Should we try to exercise more control on the people that obtain ASNs or IP address space, or should we try to change the dynamics of it? I think it's very limited. The control that RIPE can exercise on verifying all documents. I mean, we all know about forged passports. It's not that easy, and especially if you want to do it for something that generates a lot of economic money, they can provide a lot of forged documents that look very real, but in the end you cannot find the person behind it. Maybe another approach would be to try to change the dynamics and simply be able to close down those IPs obtained by ghost ISPs or phantom ISPs or bulletproof ISPs, whatever we call them, but find a way where we can close them very quickly so it's not interesting for them to obtain it anymore. It will take them a week or a month to obtain the IP addresses, but they'll be shut down within 24 hours once they use it for illegal activity. It's a suggestion.
It's a reasonable suggestion, given that there is also a dynamic between the usability of the internet and the availability of it to individuals on a free and equal basis, which is what it's, in my view at least, there for, there's always going to be this balance of how far can one intrude in order to protect the integrity of the internet. And I know this is an issue that a lot of people have vexed opinions on. They can't agree. All I would say, and I hope we would agree on this, is that the present situation is unacceptable and we should look to move the dynamic to put more pressure on the bad guys while trying to avoid interfering with the good guys. And having worked in the work I'm doing at Spam House for the last 5.5 years, I can tell you that is not an easy task, or even a simple one to describe.
Matt Ford, ISOC. I just came up here because I wanted to say that I thought that was an excellent presentation.
Thank you.
And I wanted to respond a bit to some of what I was hearing from Max, although not specifically on the issue of postal mail. I think it is absolutely imperative that the community addresses these issues rapidly. I think that, you know, arguments along the lines of, well, this solution won't be perfect because we, you know, I can envisage ways around this. If anything that will cause the bad guys to have to expose themselves more, anything that will cause them difficulty, that is, you know, relatively easy for the community to implement in terms of policy, in terms of new mechanisms, we need to do this as soon as possible, because the alternatives, both in terms of the degraded utility of the network and the incentives for other people to step in and tell us how to run it, are not good.
With your permission, I'll take a copy of that, what you just said, from the notes and add it to my version of this presentation I'm giving at Internet 2 in Baltimore next week. Thank you. Very, very heartful words, and I appreciate them. We can't solve the problem immediately. Solving this problem is a bit like writing a computer program. You write something you think is going to do the job, you try it out, and you find where it's going wrong. Then you go fix the bugs. And just like writing a computer program, you will never get it bug-free. So with this, we will never get it perfect. But I think we can do better than we're doing now if we communicate more about it, if we share the understanding about it with each other on hopefully a reasonable way without getting too emotional. We've all got to solve this problem together, and it's not going to be easy.
Filiz Yılmaz, Raypen CC, Policy Development Manager. Just a tiny little clarification together with a comment. You mentioned the effect of having different mechanisms among RARs, how they operate basically, if they had LAR structures or not. Just a tiny little clarification there, because our region or our membership may be understanding one term with one semantics while it is used with another term in another region. So for in our region, in RIPE, there is LAR mechanisms and there is assignment window mechanism, which gives the LARs some freedom to make assignments for their customers without the approval of the RAR. This means RIPE and CC doesn't see those requests as approval requests. While in, for example, in APNIC, the same system is there. They have LARs and they have an assignment window system too. EFRINIC, for example, has an LAR system, but they don't have that assignment window system, so everything goes to the RAR. So I hope this makes it clear in terms of the comparison you were making.
Thank you, Phyllis. Yes, I was aware of the EFRINIC situation, although I make the point that AFRINIC currently has assigned a /20 to Nitelnet, the Nigerian monopoly telecoms operator, and there isn't actually such an entity at all. AFRINIC have been told that and have not fixed the problem. And that block has been used by a very well-known American spammer, Michael Lindsay, to set up in the Northern California area and run the snowshoe spam I was talking about earlier using that block. as an AFNIC have been told and haven't revoked it. My understanding was that APNIC were being quite strict in verifying that entities who got allocations out of their ranges were what they said they were. And although when, again, back in 2003, APNIC were a fairly major scandal in terms of their WHOIS data accuracy, I don't see any problems there at all now. Does anybody? In fact, the only RIRs that we see problems with are LACNIC and RIPE. And the LACNIC problems are of a total different nature.
Well, I'm going to say it's now 25 minutes past, so thank you very much, Richard, for all of that vast amount of information. So appreciation for Richard and the work there. Now, as you'll see, there's a few other agenda items, but they kind of all roll into the same thing, and they're also hopefully not going to keep, you know, be a barrier between you and your caffeine. As has been mentioned by a number of people during that talk, there are potentially problems with how, in the RIPE region, the bad guys, for want of a better phrase, but it's been used often enough, are dealt with. And every so often on the list, somebody comes on, and somebody did reasonably recently, and kind of said, why, you know, the LIRs don't care, the RIR doesn't care, why aren't these people being dealt with? And quite often in that situation, thank you very much, quite often in that situation, we turn around and say, okay, you think something should be done. In order for something to be done, a policy has to be put in place. And then the list suddenly goes quiet again. Apparently, writing documents is hard, which I'm sure Felice would vehemently disagree with. They can just be knocked out in half an hour, you know, it's fine. But in all seriousness, we are looking at a few things which kind of all come under the same heading. We're looking to see, in cooperation with other working groups, whether there are policies we can put in place that will improve the situation. And these policies have to come from the community. All of you guys, all the people aren't here, all the people on the mailing list. And it does slightly worry me that every time anyone suddenly kind of goes, well, look, guys, you want to put any of those thoughts into a policy, there's nothing further. So I would encourage any of you, and there's been many useful things said here today, to see if you can write those things down. And myself and Richard, and indeed the RIPE NCC staff, are here to help you with formulating your thoughts and wishes into a policy which can be put to the rest of the community for its feedback. We don't expect you to have Shakespearean writing abilities or to knock out an O'Reilly book, but even if you have a starting point, we'll do everything we can to help you formulate that into a policy suitable for dissemination. Part and parcel of that is what I've got there under updates to RIPE 409 and indeed new documentation. We stated fairly plainly when we set this working group, or rather changed the charter of this working group, that we wanted to update RIPE 409, which is a BCP document about how to deal with people who might be spamming on your network or at your exchange point or otherwise. And now that we've kind of got a session or two under our belts and a couple of months, we're now looking at very definitely sitting down and writing that new document, which would be stripping out, completely obsoleting RIPE 409 and producing a document which deals with a much wider amount of network abuse. We've spoken to a couple of different groups about this who have expressed their interest in helping out. But obviously, if there's anyone else who wishes to help out, then please let us know. Sorry, you have a question or a comment or otherwise?
Hi, I'm Kostas Zorbadelos from Greek Telecommunications Organization. On that subject precisely, I just wanted to mention, I heard in the presentation earlier that the ISPs, most of the times, are the ones that suffer the most. Well, I can agree totally with that. And I would like to have a best current practices document that describes also specific technical measures that the ISPs can enforce so as to help the situation. I mean, I have read the RIPE 409 document, and I believe it's in a bit higher level than I would like it to be. I would like to know and to have in my hands an arsenal of measures, of specific measures, that can attack problems.
Okay.
So I believe it's a good idea to have to enhance this document with something like that.
Well, what I'm going to propose, especially as it's 3:30 now, and after our slightly truncated working group session in Dubai, I didn't think for one moment we'd be going into the coffee break today, but, you know, yay, to a certain extent. What I'm going to suggest is that there's obviously lots of ideas and lots of potential policies out there. We will publish the mailing list, the minutes of this meeting, substantially sooner than we did this time. We'll also obviously publish some of the high-level points, such as the things that have touched on policy, and indeed the updating of RIPE 409 and the changing of that, and an additional call for assistance with that. And what we'll then try and do is work with the community as much as possible to put in place the high-level BCP, to put in place more documentation on specific technical measures, and indeed to look and see if there's specific policies that we can create for the RIPE region. And obviously, like I said, there'll be a cry for help because myself and Richard aren't quite in the position to do all of this ourselves. So we'll details. We'll endeavor to put that together, and we'll endeavor to have obviously as much as possible done before Lisbon, so we can, even if we don't have the full documents done, we can see where we are and where the direction is going at that point in time. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Now, this is put in as my co-chair hat. There's something else we're going to need from you, and the representative from Greek Telecommunications, I think that'll be, I guess it's OTE.net, flagged this as an issue we need to think about. There is no point our writing a document that says an ISP ought to do something if his country's laws don't allow it. Now, there is one country in Europe, for example, where an ISP cannot delete a file even if it's malware, on a hosted server. There is one country in the RIPE region which does not allow customers to be disconnected for abuse, and so on. I've just picked out two examples. We need you to tell us, as a team, you know, the working group, what limitations there are in particular countries. And in those countries where those limitations are seen to be lethal limitations, then obviously we've got to start thinking about the community talking to those governments and saying, hey, you're causing a problem.
Yeah. If it's very brief, please.
There will always be legal matters. For all I can say, I'm not a lawyer, and I think we should start with something and then correct the bugs along the way, like the...
Absolutely. No, I mean, I think, yeah. Like I said, we'll work on putting drafts together, certainly between now and Lisbon in October. And obviously, we'll be putting out another call for help on the mailing list. Right, we are 5 minutes into the coffee break, and that's an inhuman thing to do to you all. So thank you all very much, and well, we'll see you in Lisbon. Thanks.